Chapter 6. This time the memory shift is different. Before, I was falling through time, falling through memory. Now I feel still. And suddenly, I'm standing outside a secluded ranch in Coahuila, Mexico. In this memory, Juan and her Sepan are carrying boxes into the house. It's moving day. This is the first place Juan and her Sepan, Hilda, her Sepan's name was Hilda, settled after the guard landed on Earth and parted ways. Wait, how do I know all this? It's strange. In addition to finding myself existing here, observing this particular moment in one's life, I also have a general sense of her memories of the time. I know the things that she knows and remember what she remembers. The memories are so vivid. It's like they're my own. It's like I'm her. Ghost One appears next to me, watching with me as the younger version of herself and Hilda unpack dishes in the kitchen. It's creepy to have her here. Gives me a feeling like vertigo. I try to ignore her, but she just keeps talking to me. "We stayed here for a while," she says, sounding almost wistful. "Then Hilda thought she saw some of your peeps snooping around the city, so we had to leave." The guard move a lot, city to city, country to country. Their movements unpredictable. My father will want to know this. It's completely the opposite of the way we Mogadorians have done it, consolidating our power in bases across the globe. That's why they're so difficult to track. "She was sort of a drag sometimes," says one, watching her Sepan. "Probably a lot like your dickbag dad. Except, you know, not evil." She rubs her fingers together and cackles an evil cackle in punctuation. "Shut up," I spit, sounding angrier than I even realized I was. "You don't know him." I find myself studying Hilda in spite of myself. She's in her late 50s, and her face is wrinkled both with the natural lines of age and the premature weathering of stress. Her gray hair tightly bound in a stern braid. Her eyes have a hardness to them. Her voice is steely and measured, even when just telling one, the real one, which cupboard the plates belong in. Truth be told, she does remind me of the general. "I loved her like a mom, though," says Ghost One, sadness breaking her voice. My mind drifts to the dead old woman we left to rot in Malaysia, and I feel something like guilt, but quickly push it away. "She's messing with your head, Adamus." "I wish you'd stop talking to me," I tell her. "Yeah? Well, I wish your people hadn't killed me." After Mexico, Juan and Hilda move to Austin, Texas. I try to push my way out of these memories, to get back to that night on the Lorik airstrip, where I can actually find out something useful. But Juan won't let me. Somehow, she's blocking me. I may be an uninvited guest in her mind, but it's still hers. She can't kick me out entirely. But she does have some control over which rooms I'm allowed to visit. Most of the time when I try to force my way through her memory, one makes me sit through one of her and Hilda's training sessions. "I used to hate these," one says, grinning. "Hope you feel the same." Hilda is a master martial artist, though it's a fighting style that would never make it into Mogadorian training, where brute force is prized above all else. Hilda's is a defensive martial art, one that uses an attacker's own momentum, focusing strikes on nerve centers that will temporarily incapacitate the enemy. Stuck in these memories, when boredom sets in, I find myself aping Hilda's movements, practicing alongside young Juan. I know that none of this is real, that it's all in my mind, or Juan's mind. I'm not so sure there's a difference. My slight frame has never served me well in Mogadorian combat training, much to the disappointment of my father and the amusement of Ivan. But in one's memories, I never get tired. Even if this training is basically imaginary, It feels good to finally move in a way that suits me. Besides, I'm supposed to be gathering intelligence. How the guard fight is essential information. In the earlier training memories, one is an eager pupil. She practices with Hilda from dawn until sunset, listening rapt as Hilda tells stories of the Lorik heroes she's helped train. Hilda is full of tales of honorable competition, of noble battles fought on Lorien. They're meant to inspire, to demonstrate to one the Lorik spirit of perseverance. Compared to the stories in the Great Book, there is a surprising lack of bloody violence and decimation in them. "One day," says Hilda, "you will take your place among them as a great hero to our people. You will be known as the one who protected the Eight." I can feel the pride Number One takes in Hilda's words, but also the doubt. There's a part of her that wonders how she can possibly stand alone in opposition to the Mogadorians that conquered her entire planet in a single night. "I always wondered why I couldn't have gotten lucky and been Number Nine," muses One, as I practice forms next to her younger self. "But no, I have to go and be the first, otherwise known as the most doomed of nine doomed assholes. The elders really screwed me over." In Austin, Hilda lets One start attending school, all the better to fit in. I'm dragged along on these memories of her classes. School seems so pointless. The general would never even consider letting us freely socialize with the humans. And yet, as the memories go by, I find myself being drawn into One's life. She makes some friends, takes up skateboarding. It all starts to feel like something approaching a normal life. At the same time, her training slips. She starts blowing off sessions, even after her telekinesis develops, which is when she should have been working extra hard. For all her rigidity, Hilda couldn't really do anything to One if she slipped out a window to go hang out with her friends. How do you ground the last hope for a dying race? I don't really care about One's freaking social life. This girl is the enemy of my people. Her death is inevitable, has already happened. And yet, drifting through her memories, I can't help but put myself in her situation. Even though she travels the earth under the constant threat of execution, I realize that One has gotten to see more of this planet than I have. The general has never allowed us to travel out of Washington. Hilda might be a tough Sipan, but she still allows One to go to school, to make friends, to live a life not entirely dedicated to war. I wonder what that's like. I wonder what my life would be like without the need to serve Mogadorian expansion, without the drills and training, the supervised readings from Ra's Great Book. "This is like one of my all-time favorites," says Ghost One, introducing the memory of her punching a cheerleader in the face. The cheerleader started it. She'd been picking on One since she started school in Austin. It's weird, but I feel some of One's sense of satisfaction. Of course, the punch gets her kicked out of school, which is all the reason Hilda needs to relocate them again. They leave Austin in a beat-up station wagon, heading for California. One sulks in the passenger seat the whole ride, reclined all the way back, ignoring Hilda in favor of the three seashells she keeps levitated above her with her telekinesis. We Mogadorians have been warned of the guard's deadly telekinesis. Watching One juggle the seashells, scrunching up her nose in concentration, it doesn't seem all that deadly. More like mesmerizing. And it's not just the telekinesis either. The way her blonde hair is fanned beneath her... I turn away. Was I just checking out the dead guard whose memories I've stolen? I tell myself it was for research purposes. Although, a description of how the sun brings out the blonder streaks in One's nice hair is likely not the intel my father expects of me. When they arrive in California, Hilda tries to inspire One with some kind of Lorik magic so that she'll start taking her training more seriously. You'll want to see this, Ghost One tells me, appearing at my side to watch. Using what appear at first to be plain glass orbs, Hilda creates a floating map of the Lorik galaxy. The swirling cosmos, the bright orange sun, and the dead, gray planet, Lorien. Do you see what the Mogadorians have done? Hilda asks young number one. One nods, staring at the ruined planet. Hilda steps close to the floating Lorien orb and gently blows across its surface. When she does, the smog and fire clear from the planet's surface. Lorien looks like it must have before the first great expansion. Rich and lush. Thriving. The change fades quickly, the planet going gray again. This is why we fight, says Hilda quietly, her eyes watery. Not just to avenge our planet and our people, and to one day bring life back to Lorien, but to prevent this fate from befalling Earth. Do you understand why you are so important? I don't pay attention to one's muted reply. I'm too distracted by the vision of Lorien. Its surface is a hideously charred black, the planet's ruined atmosphere leaking into the space around it. Seeing the planet like this, my people's greatest victory, it doesn't look like anything to be proud of. Is that what you want for the entire universe? Ghost One asks me, gesturing to her destroyed home. I've never seen this before, I reply, trying to keep my voice neutral. The sight of Lorien disturbs me. To think such thoughts is treason. But if our coming to Earth means even half the destruction brought down on Lorien, would it still be a place worth living in? Is that what Mogadorian progress looks like? Ghost One presses. Please, I say, shaking my head. Stop talking to me. I just want her to go away. I don't want her to see my doubt. Chapter 7. I'm standing on the beach. I can't feel anything here in one's memories. But if I concentrate hard, I can almost imagine what it must be like to have the Pacific Ocean lapping at my ankles and the wet sand squishing between my toes. I've never been in the ocean before. When I'm finally awake again, I'd like to try the real thing. I take a second to imagine a trip to the ocean with the general. My father out of uniform in a pair of flower print swim trunks, pulling a cooler filled with cookout supplies out of the trunk of our family's convertible. My mom and Kelly build a sandcastle, while Ivan and I see which one of us can swim out the farthest. He wins, because even in my fantasy, I'm a realist. I swim back to shore, and the general is waiting with a hamburger. Seriously? Asks Ghost One, standing on the beach beside me. And I realize I have a ridiculous, goofy grin on my face. I quickly let it fade. You killed my entire race so you could enjoy a beach barbecue? Stay out of my thoughts, I say weakly, aware of the hypocrisy. Psh, snorts One, rolling her eyes at me. I wish that I could, dude. Arguing with One's ghost certainly isn't what my father would describe as productive reconnaissance, so I turn away, trying to ignore her. In this memory, the real number One has just finished up a day of surfing. Turns out she's a natural, the only one of her crew of surfer buddies not to wipe out today. Between this and the skateboarding, she started to wonder if maybe enhanced balance isn't going to be one of her legacies. I'd never tell One this, but I've enjoyed the surfer memory. In fact, I'd never tell anyone that. Please stop checking out my past self, Ghost One says at my side. I'm not, I protest. The memories keep moving. One bounds out of the water, her surfboard passing right through me as she leaps into the waiting arms of a tanned and muscular young human. Wade. One had rededicated herself to training after Hilda's display of the solar system, at least until she met Wade. Wade is 16 years old. He has shoulder-length brown hair, strands of which he keeps in grungy little braids. He owns a beat-up Volkswagen van that he sleeps in, even though his wallet contains a couple credit cards paid for by his parents, a fact one discovered while she was snooping through Wade's things to make sure he wasn't a secret Mogadorian. As if.
"I felt like my parents had my whole life planned out," explained Wade on the night he and One first met,
his arm slung around her shoulders, the two of them huddled in front of a bonfire on the beach.
"Go to college, get my law degree, join Dad at his practice. Such a bourgeois life plan. It just wasn't for me, you know?"
"I get it," replied One, way more interested in Wade's muscular arm than in whatever he was saying. "I guess she liked him, or at least liked the rush of being with him, an added bonus being that it pissed off Hilda. I didn't get the attraction.
So I left that whole scene behind, hopped in my van, and decided to surf my way down the coast. No plan at all. I'm just gonna, like, be for a while."
Wade paused.
"Hey, has anyone ever told you how soulful your eyes are?"
One swoons. "Oh, come on," I think, and Ghost One appears at my side.
"Cut me some slack," she says. "He's hot, and I was stupid. I mean, I wasn't that stupid. I knew he was full of it, obviously, but look at him. He's hot."
"I wouldn't know," I say self-consciously. That memory was a couple months before the one I slip into next. We're still at the beach, and One wriggles out of her wetsuit and settles on the sand next to Wade. She's been regularly skipping training to come surfing with Wade. One and Hilda are barely speaking, except for when Hilda tries to chastise her. "I haven't been enjoying these Wade memories. They're of no relevance to the Mogadorian cause. Besides, I feel like One could be doing so much better."
"I was having fun,"
says One, popping up to defend herself again.
"I liked pretending I was normal."
I don't say anything.
"Didn't you ever want to get away from it all?"
asks One. She knows that I do. She's been rummaging through my thoughts, too.
"You and that douche you hang out with spend a lot of time in D.C., but you never talk to any other kids."
"It's forbidden."
"Why?"
"To interact directly could compromise operational integrity," I reply, quoting from the great book.
"You sound like a robot,"
she says.
"They don't want you to know the humans, because then it'd be harder for you to kill them. Just like with me."
"What do you mean, just like with you?"
"I mean that you kind of like me," she says,
looking at me in a way that makes me feel uncomfortable.
"They didn't know what they were doing sending you in here. If you knew all this about me before, would you still want to kill me?"
My head hurts thinking about it, and I wave One away. I am not ready to go back to the memory of the riverbank in Malaysia. Then, I remind myself that Malaysia is in the future, not the past.
"Don't feel too bad," she says. "I don't know if I'd want to kill you either."
Chapter 8. This is how my people find her. The general didn't share these details with me, but I know them now. Wade believes in taking a stand against capitalism. He does this by shoplifting at every opportunity he gets. He also talks, sometimes endlessly, about the amazing record collection he was forced to leave behind when he left his parents' mansion. This puts an idea in One's head. She's going to shoplift some records from a store by the beach for him. Part of her wants to impress Wade. Another part of her just wants to experience the thrill that he's talked about. But One gets caught coasting out of the store with a backpack full of merchandise. The owner of the store is a take-no-prisoners type. he calls the cops.
How was Wade even going to listen to those? I ask. Does his van have a record player?
One laughs as we watch her former self being slapped into handcuffs.
I didn't even think of that.
Number One is taken to the police station. Her grandmother is contacted. The police are going to let her off with a warning. But a particularly overzealous detective notices the Lorik charm on One's ankle. He mistakes the charm for a brand and starts asking One about gang affiliation.
Yeah, sneers One. I'm in a gang called the Space Invaders. We do surf-by shootings. No lifeguard can stop us.
The detective doesn't seem to think it's a very funny joke. He takes a picture of One. He takes a picture of the Lorik charm. He uploads both images to a statewide database. As soon as the flash on the camera goes off, I know that this is how it happened. My people have teams working around the clock, patrolling the internet, even the internal government sites, for tips, just like this. We have artificial intelligences set up that do nothing but scan image feeds for anything resembling the Lorik charm. After 4 years of searching, One is on our radar. Hilda doesn't lecture One when she picks her up from the police station. She doesn't need words to express her disappointment. One knows what it means to have had her picture taken by the police. For the first time, One's rebellious streak gives way to fear. She packs a bag with shaking hands before Hilda even tells her to. I'm reminded of the way my hand shook after I saw her killed. It wasn't until then that the war we're fighting began to feel real. One must be feeling the same way now. This time, they travel light. Hilda thinks they need to get out of America. They rush to the airport and board the first international flight they can. Their destination is Malaysia. One notices the two pale men in trench coats at the airport, but she doesn't realize what they are. I do. I recognize my own. For all their precautions, all their training, all their knowledge of their enemies, what's so clear to me is completely unrecognized by Hilda and One. A Mogadorian scout team is on to them. I know the protocol in a situation like this. When my people have a lead on a Lorik, VAT-born scouts are dispatched to every conceivable place of departure. We cover them all. Airports, train and bus stations, rental car huts. Their objective isn't to engage. Their job is just to keep an eye on Number One. You need to lose them, I find myself muttering. You need to lose the scouts before you flee.
Oh, thanks for telling me, dude.
The One standing next to me says. She has a sad, rueful look on her face. For some reason, I'm positioning myself between the scouts and One. It makes no sense. I'm a ghost here. They see right through me. And besides, this has already happened. Nothing I can do can change it. My stomach still drops when they board the flight to Malaysia. I can't see the scouts anymore. They've disappeared into the crowd. I know what they're doing, though. They're radioing back to my father or some other superior, arranging to have a scout team wading across the ocean when One's flight touches down. My team. I dread seeing what comes next.
Chapter 9.
Hilda and One hide out in an abandoned stilt house on the Rajong River. Their closest neighbors, the endlessly screeching monkeys that populate the jungle. Hilda is planning a trip into Kuala Lumpur, where she'll take some money out of their bank account, enough to finance their next move. It's peaceful, without any of the distractions of America. When the river is clear, One practices her telekinesis on its bank. By the time our team arrives, after an endless flight through who knows how many time zones, I've completely lost track of what day it is. All I know is that the sun is beginning to rise. Hilda hears the first wave coming. Our soldiers don't make any effort to hide their approach. They have the house surrounded. Hilda shakes Number One awake, just as the warriors kick in the door.
The Sepan moves fast for an old woman. It's easy to see her as the great martial artist, trainer of young guard, that she was on Lorien. She ducks effortlessly under a dagger strike, burying her fist in the throat of an off-balance warrior. Before the first Mogadorian even hits the ground, Hilda has wrapped her arms around the head of a second, snapping his neck. I catch myself cheering her on, then stop myself. The next Mogadorian through the door dives for Hilda and places her in a headlock. But Hilda, in a movement so subtle I barely even see it, manages to turn his hold against him, flipping him onto his back, even though he's twice her size. That's when he whips his blaster from his holster and orders not to harm her, suddenly forgotten in his humiliation, fires it right at her chest. When Hilda hits the ground, one screams. The entire house wobbles, its stilts suddenly vibrating. Screaming out in grief and agony, one stomps the floor. A seismic wave erupts from her foot, tearing up the floorboards and sending the Mogadorians flying through the tightly woven sticks of the stilt house's walls. Her first legacy has developed. Too late. The little that's left of the house is listing on its stilts. With the Mogadorians regrouping outside, one cradles Hilda in her arms. The wound is fatal. Hilda spits a bubble of blood when she tries to speak. "It's not too late for you," Hilda manages to say. "You have to run." One is crying. She feels responsible. She feels helpless. "I failed you," sobs one. "Not yet, you haven't," replies Hilda. "Go, now." I'm standing right next to her, willing her to move, even though I know what's waiting for her on the riverbank. The ghost one, the dead girl who's been my companion through all of these memories, has abandoned me now. She's been gone since the airport. One hesitates for an instant at Hilda's order, and then, knowing it's her only choice, flings herself through one of the windows just as the stilts buckle, and the house finally collapses into the river. The Mogadorians meet her on the riverbank. The house's falling ceiling passes harmlessly through me. I watch as one produces another seismic burst, experimenting with her newfound power, and the wet ground of the riverbank opens up to swallow a pair of advancing Mogadorians. I remember this. I peer down the riverbank, wondering if she could have seen me where I stood, watching with Ivan and my father. No. I was too far away, her attention too focused on the battle around her. I should be enjoying this, a chance to replay this great victory up close and personal. There's nothing someone like Ivan wouldn't give to be able to witness this again. It's like a highlight reel of Mogadorian dominance. Yet, I want to turn away. I was ashamed to admit it the first time, but not now. This battle, one unarmed teenager against 24 highly trained Mogadorians, repulses me. Of course, one isn't completely defenseless. The ground around her continues to shake, leaving the Mogadorians stumbling and off balance. She picks up some sharp sections of the broken house with her telekinesis and lances them through the nearest Mogadorians. The hit warriors disintegrate into ash and are lost in the muddy river water. I feel nothing for the dead soldiers. We are taught about acceptable losses. These strike teams are expendable. One is pushing herself too hard. Her newly discovered legacy is barely under control. Her telekinesis sloppy from months of blowing off training. She is already close to exhaustion, and the Mogadorians just keep coming. Finally, one of the largest Vat-born warriors manages to evade her defensive attacks and grab her from behind, yanking both of her arms behind her back to restrain her. As he does it, one yelps in pain just before she manages to slip from his grasp. It wasn't a loud scream, probably more a cry of surprise than one of injury. But it's enough for the Mogadorians to understand. They've hurt her.
she can be hurt. And then things change. I know the Mogadorian training well enough to see the soldier's strategies shift instantly. They know it's her, the first, number one. She can be killed. And every single one of them wants to be the one to do it. One's in such a panic, fighting blindly, that she never even notices the Mogadorian warrior who manages to grab that particular glory. I don't know the warrior's name. He's just another faceless trooper under my father's command. He approaches her from behind, his glowing sword drawn. He takes his time, plodding his steps carefully across the vibrating ground. When he's close enough, the warrior lunges, burying his sword in One's back, the blade emerging from her abdomen. From this moment on, he will be a hero to my people. Maybe the only good thing about death is that you never have to relive it. You never have to remember the pain. Except, One does. Though she'd been gone since the airport, Ghost One is suddenly next to me again. She's hunched and sobbing, her mind crying out to mine through the link we share. She can feel herself dying. Her mind throbs with pain and fear. As it does, I feel the mental block she'd been maintaining crumble and fall. Just like the walls of the Stilt House, she's lost control over her memories. Now is my chance to return to the Lorik airstrip, to see the identities of the other guard. As Number One's body slips lifeless to the ground, everything begins to blur again, like it did when I first entered One's memories. Only now, I'm in control. I cycle backward through her memories, knowing exactly what I want to see. Chapter 10. I sit on the beach, waiting for One to emerge from the water. When she does, her wet suit dripping, surfboard slung under her arm, I stop the memory. Then I loop backward a bit further, watching her surf a wave and then return to the beach again. This is the memory I chose to return to. I replay the scene over and over, unsure how many times I watch her come out of the water. Until, eventually, Ghost One appears beside me. She looks surprised to see me here, but sits down on the beach next to me. For a while, we don't say anything. We just stare out at the ocean, watching Number One surf through one of her last happy days. Part of me wishes I could grab a board and go out there with her, but that's not the way this works. This moment will have to do. "I'm sorry you died," I blurt out, meaning it. "Yeah," answers One. "That sucked." I think back to the floating vision of the solar system. What will happen when my people commence their invasion on Earth? Will this beach look like the ones on Lorien must now? "I don't understand why any of this has to happen," I say.
"Maybe you should ask your pops. He's got all the answers, right?"
I nod my head slowly, even though the thought of bringing these feelings to the general makes me feel nauseous. One is watching me, a small smile forming at the edges of her mouth. "I'm going to," I say, feeling suddenly resolute. "I want to know why."
"Good,"
replies One, and she squeezes my hand, even though I can sense that part of her is still sort of repulsed by me. A shiver goes down my spine, and without quite knowing why, I quickly pull my hand away.
"What happens now?"
I ask One.
"Now,"
she says,
"you wake up."
Chapter 11. I wake up in my bedroom. My bedroom. Back at Ashwood Estates. I'm not in One's life anymore. It's morning, and my eyes adjust slowly to the early light. It hurts to open them. My entire body feels sore and weak,
I can't sit up, but I take a few deep breaths and focus on wiggling some feeling back into my toes. I'm covered by two layers of blankets. One of my arms, pale, paler than usual, rests on top of the blankets, hooked up to a plastic tube that leads to a nutrient drip. Strange. How long have I been out that they had to hook me up to an IV? I hear a noise at my bedside, and slowly, painfully, turn my head. There's a girl kneeling on the floor next to my bed, her back to me. She's narrow and gawky in that almost a teenager sort of way. There's something oddly familiar about her, and I struggle to place her from around the neighborhood. What's she doing in my bedroom? The girl has a Build a Piken set spread out on the floor before her. Resembling one of Earth's toy chemistry sets, it's one of the few games we Mogadorians are permitted. I'm too weak to speak, still working moisture back into my desert of a mouth, so I watch in silence as the girl drags a scalpel down the belly of a wriggling earthworm. Then she fills an eyedropper with a clear solution and dribbles it into the worm's open wound. The worm only writhes at first, but then its body begins to contort and change. Nubs of pliable flesh begin to protrude from the wound where the solution hit. The girl grabs a pair of tweezers and carefully stretches out the flesh, helping it to form into six spindly spider-like legs. Haltingly, the tiny piken manages to get these legs under it, hefting the twisting remains of the worm's body. It scuttles a few steps across the floor, then collapses. The girl watches, her head cocked, as the piken worm tries to regain its footing. It can't, toppling onto what would be its back, legs kicking helplessly in the air. After a few moments of futile struggling, the piken's legs stop moving, and it disintegrates into ash. The girl wipes up the ash with a damp washcloth and produces a new worm from a nearby box. Something about this makes me feel incredibly sad. Not for the worm, but more for the girl. It's disturbing to see how casually she alters and extinguishes the worm. It makes me uncomfortable to think how little my people value life. As soon as I have this thought, I get a strange, sick feeling in my stomach. It goes against everything written in the book, everything my people believe. An image of one impaled on a Mogadorian blade springs to mind. I push it away. I try to shift in the bed a little bit more, and it makes a noise. The girl turns her head sharply, her eyes widening when she sees me watching her. "You're awake!" she shouts, excited. "Kelly." The girl is my sister, but she's grown up. When she springs to her feet, it's clear that she's almost a foot taller than when I last saw her, which should have been just yesterday afternoon, although it feels much longer. Was much longer, apparently. How, I cough, my throat aching. How long? I manage. Kelly has already sprung to the doorway, shouting downstairs for our mother. She rushes back to me. 3 years, she says. Byra, you've been sleeping for 3 years. Chapter 12. I stare at myself in my bedroom mirror. I'm taller than I was. I'm skinnier, too, even though I didn't think that was possible. Whatever my parents had hooked me up to during my coma, it certainly didn't build any muscle. I suck in a deep breath and watch my rib cage protrude through my chest's too pale skin. Even standing in front of the mirror, examining my 3 years older body, takes a physical toll. I must look wobbly, because my mother grabs me by the elbow and leads me back to bed. She's been quiet since shooing Kelly and her rapid-fire questions from the room, giving me time to gather myself. I'm grateful for that.
My mother has always been the gentle one in the family, often to the general's chagrin. I can tell by the way she looks at me that she didn't expect me to wake up. She strokes my hair.
"How do you feel?" she asks.
"Strange," I reply. "It's true, my body feels weak and foreign, having grown up without me. But it's more than that. It feels strange to be back here with my own people, knowing what I do now. Even my mother, here stroking my hair, is a brutal warrior at heart, intent on killing the guard." I picture the Mogadorians swarming one, feel her fear and anger anew. I can't help but see my mother's face on one of the soldiers. As she gently takes my hand in hers, I'm imagining my mother plunging a sword into one's back. Suddenly, I don't trust my own family.
"I don't remember anything," I say, even though she didn't ask. "The machine didn't work."
My mother nods.
"Your father will be disappointed."
I decided to lie when I was still living in one's memories, when we were sitting on the beach together. I won't be telling my people anything that I saw. Not that anything I learned would help Mogador win its war anyway. What could I even say? That, unlike Mogadorians, the Lorik are allowed to develop individuality? That their freedom from doctrines like those in the Great Book is simultaneously their greatest strength and ultimate weakness? That I've seen what our people did to Lorien, and that it looks like shit?
Yeah, that would go over big.
I'm grateful for the chance to practice this lie on my mother. When it comes time to tell the general, he won't be so gentle.
"Dr. Anu will have to go back to the drawing board, I guess," I say, probing a bit to see if she bought it.
"That won't be happening," replies my mother. "When you didn't wake up..." She hesitates, but I don't need her to finish telling me. I can picture the general enraged, storming into Anu's laboratory and drawing his sword.
"Your father never liked Anu. Honestly, the way that old man talked, I'm surprised it didn't happen sooner."
There are heavy footfalls on the staircase, approaching my room. So here comes the general at last, here to debrief his only true-born son, probably to rebuke me for not waking up sooner.
"What's up, skinny?"
Ivan leans in the doorway, grinning. How old would he be now? 14? He looks like he could play linebacker for a college football team. Like me, Ivan has grown taller in the last 3 years, but he's also grown wider in every conceivable way. I imagine all the strength and combat training he's been doing without me, likely coached by the general himself. I wonder how his Mogadorian theory grades have fared without me around to coach him.
"Did you have a nice nap?"
he asks.
"Yeah," I mutter. "Thanks."
"Awesome," he says. "Anyway, father wants to see you downstairs."
I feel my mother grow tense beside me. Since when did Ivan start calling the general father?
"Adamus needs his rest," says my mother.
Ivan snorts.
"All he's been doing is resting,"
he says, and turns to me.
"Come on, get dressed."
There is a familiar note of authority in Ivan's voice. He sounds very much like the general. Chapter 13. I'm expecting Ivan to lead me to my father's office, but instead, we take the elevator down into the tunnels beneath Ashwood Estates.
"You woke up just in time for some action,"
he says.
"Great," I reply, struggling not to sound half-hearted. "What's happening?"
"You'll see," he says. "Big shit going down."
When the elevator doors hiss open, Ivan slaps me hard on the back. In my weakened state, I stumble forward a few steps. I'd probably have fallen right to the floor if not for Ivan grabbing me. He pulls me into a brotherly embrace, but in addition to an intimidating amount of strength, I feel a kind of menace
in the way Ivan pats me roughly on the back. My palms begin to sweat.
"Seriously," he whispers, "so glad you're awake. Father's going to be pleased that his favorite son is finally up and about."
Ivan leads me to the briefing room. There, 24 Mogadorian warriors sit in a semicircle before the general. My father is as big as ever, his towering presence commanding the attention of everyone assembled, none of them even noticing when Ivan and I slip into the room. Projected on the wall behind my father is the image of a red-haired man in his early 40s. The picture is grainy. It looks as if it was culled from surveillance footage.
"This man," my father intones, mid-briefing, "calls himself Conrad Hoyle. We believe, based on several tips from sources as well as extensive surveillance, that he is a member of the Lorik Insurgency, a Sepan."
My father clicks a button on the remote in his meaty hand. Conrad Hoyle's face is replaced by an image of a burned-down cottage in some rural area.
"One of our scout teams had an altercation with Hoyle at this location in the Scottish Highlands. We sustained heavy losses. Hoyle was able to escape."
Another image appears. Conrad Hoyle, seated on a train, his face intent on a laptop screen. Whoever took this picture clearly did so with a camera phone hidden a few rows ahead of Hoyle.
"A secondary scout team was able to pick up Hoyle's trail and has been following him ever since. We believe he and his charge, a priority guard target we know to be roughly 13 years old, and female, have split up. It stands to reason that Hoyle and his guard have a safe house where they plan to reunite."
A city appears behind my father, and I recognize it from my studies of Earth's prime urban targets. London.
"Conrad Hoyle is headed to London," continues the general. "There, we believe he will reunite with his guard and attempt to disappear."
My gaze drifts over the warriors in the room. All of them are paying strict attention to my father. Yet, something is off.
"We will follow Hoyle to London and wait for him to lead us to the girl. And we will terminate or apprehend them both. Preferably terminate."
As the general makes this pronouncement, I notice her. She's sitting in the front row. Her blonde hair stands out in this gathering of burly, dark-haired Mogadorians. But no one else notices her. No one else can even see her. Slowly, one turns around in her seat. She looks right at me.
"You have to stop them," says one.
Chapter 14. The briefing room has emptied out, except for the general and Ivan. I'm seated at one of the desks previously occupied by a Mogadorian warrior. My head is swimming, just like it was when I first woke up. My father looms over me, studying me. He sets a glass of water down on the desk, and I drink greedily. "What happened?" I ask.
"You fainted," snickers Ivan.
My father spins on Ivan.
"Boy,"
he snarls,
"leave us."
As Ivan sulks from the room, I think back to the briefing, to one appearing. Was I hallucinating? It felt so real, just like all those times when we spoke inside her memories. But all that was like a dream, a construction of my mind. She shouldn't be able to appear to me now. It doesn't make sense. Yet, somehow, I know it wasn't a hallucination. Somehow, one is still inside my mind. I realize that I'm shaking. I put my head in my hands, try to focus, to steady myself. The general won't tolerate this kind of weakness. My father's large hand comes to rest on my shoulder. I look up, surprised to find him staring at me with something approaching concern.
"Are you well?" he asks.
I nod and try to steel myself for the lies that come next.
I haven't eaten, I say.
My father shakes his head. Ivanek, he growls. He was supposed to make sure you were ready before bringing you to me.
The general lifts his hand from my shoulder, the brief moment of affection forgotten. I can tell by the return of rigidity to his spine that, just like that, he's back to business. Mogadorian progress, first and foremost, no matter the cost.
What did you learn from one's memories? He asks.
Nothing, I reply, meeting his hard eyes. It didn't work. I remember being strapped down, then darkness, and now this, sir, I quickly add. My father mulls this over, appraising me. Then he nods.
As I feared, he says.
I realize that he never thought Dr. Anu's machine would work. My father will believe my lie because he expected failure. Clearly, he didn't care what happened to me in the process. I remember Dr. Anu's gamble with my father, wagering his life that his untested technology would succeed. It did work, and Anu was still killed. The Mogadorian way.
3 years wasted, broods my father. 3 years of you getting weaker, falling behind your peers. For what?
My cheeks burn with humiliation, with frustration, with anger. But what would my father do if I told him Anu's machine worked, that it gave me one's memories, and with them, doubts? Obviously, I hold my tongue.
This folly reflects poorly on our bloodline, on me, continues my father. But it is not too late to remedy that.
How, sir? I ask, knowing he expects me to respond eagerly to any opportunity to increase my honor.
You will come with us to London, he says, and hunt this guard.
Chapter 15. The next 12 hours are a blur. My father has me fitted for a new uniform. My mother feeds me mammoth meals, like the kind athletes eat before big games, if those athletes had the appetite of full-grown pikin. I am allowed a few hours' sleep in my own bed, and later on the flight across the Atlantic. I'm almost thankful for this blur of activity. It leaves me no time to think of the Lorik stowaway in my brain, or about what my father expects me to do. We arrive in London the next morning. The general has brought Ivan along, as well as 2 dozen hand-picked warriors, most of them trueborn. As a prime urban target, London is already home to a Mogadorian presence. The London-based Mogadorians have commandeered 5 floors in a downtown skyscraper to serve as their base of operations. They run a tight ship, but they've never been visited by a trueborn as high-ranking as my father. They snap to attention when the general passes through the halls, even eyeing Ivan and me respectfully as we follow on his heels. None of these loyal warriors detects the uncertainty I'm feeling inside. To them, I appear as one of their own. My father assumes command of the London Nerve Center. A wall of monitors manned by a pair of scouts provides a constant, real-time feed of London's camera network. Another set of terminals crawls the internet in search of suspicious activity and certain Lorik-related keywords. Before heading out to track Conrad Hoyle, my father wants to get the lay of the land. He orders the scouts to flip through various video feeds, the general quietly appraising several locations around the city for strategic advantages.
Our unit trailing Hoyle reports he's on a bus nearing the city center, sir, declares one of the scouts, relaying this information from his earpiece.
Good, intones my father. Then it's time for us to go.
While my father was studying video and plotting bloodshed, I was collapsing into a nearby chair, still feeling lightheaded. Ivan stands next to me, his arms folded sternly across his chest.
looking more like a young version of the general than ever. When my father turns to face us, Ivan shoots me a sidelong glance.
"Forgive me for speaking out of turn, sir," begins Ivan, "but I'm not sure your son is up to this."
My father's fist coils into a ball. His first instinct is to strike Ivan for his impudence. But then he looks at me, one eyebrow arched.
"Is that true?"
he asks. I know what Ivan's doing. He's spent the last 3 years worming his way into the general's good graces, calling him father, assuming my rightful place as his son. Figuring I was gone, Ivan's only concern has been his own advancement. Before, I never would have given him an opportunity to make me look bad. Before, I'm not sure he would have tried. The thing is, I don't know how much I care about fighting back. During all that time spent in one's memories, and even now that I've woken up, I haven't once fantasized about my promised inheritance of Washington, D.C. How could I, now that I know the price that would be paid? Ivan can have it.
"Perhaps he's right,"
I say, meeting my father's steely glare.
"In my weakened state, I could be a liability to Mogadorian victory."
Liability, Mogadorian victory. I know all the buzzwords to use on my father. Those haven't changed. He takes one last look at me, a hint of disgust in his face, before turning to Ivan.
"Come, Ivanek,"
he says, sweeping from the room. I'm left alone with the two techs. They ignore me, glued to their bank of monitors, watching as the bus containing Conrad Hoyle trundles through the city. I realize this is the first moment of peace I've had since waking up from my coma. I close my eyes and lower my head into my hands, trying to keep my mind blank, pushing away the conflicting feelings I've been having about my people. I'm relieved that I don't have to go on this operation. I don't know what I'd do if faced with the task of actually killing a guard. But then, who am I? I was raised as a ruthless hunter.
"So, that's your plan?" asks a familiar voice. "To just sit here and do nothing?"
I look up to find one sitting next to me. I jerk back in my chair, nearly toppling over, eyes wide.
"Booga booga," she says, wiggling her fingers at me. "Seriously, dude, get off your ass and do something."
"Do what?" I snap. "You think they'd hesitate to kill me, too?" One of the techs glances over his shoulder, frowning at me.
"Did you say something?" he asks.
I give him a blank look, then slowly shake my head. He turns back to his monitors. When I look over to where one was sitting, the chair is empty. Great. Now I'm crazy.
"Look," says one of the techs. "Something is happening."
I turn my attention to the screen, where Hoyle's bus has jerked to a sudden stop. The doors fly open, and panicked passengers begin streaming off. One of the rear windows explodes outward, a man flying through it. Before he can hit the ground, his body disintegrates into ash.
"He's on to us,"
observes the other tech, both of them leaning forward to watch the action. Bright flashes of gunfire pop across the screen, and then the back of the bus goes up in flames. As it does, I watch Conrad Hoyle emerge from the front doors. He's much larger than his picture indicated. Hoyle holds a submachine gun in his hand.
"By Ra,"
says the tech, sounding almost giddy.
"He's going to be a tough one." "We should be out there,"
grumbles the other. Most of the pedestrians are fleeing the scene of the flaming bus, like any sane person would. Except there are others that move towards the wreck, men in dark trench coats, shoving their way through the frightened crowd. The Mogadorian strike team has arrived. They're greeted by a hail of gunfire from Hoyle, and they quickly take cover before shooting back. If my father and Ivan aren't out there yet, enduring Hoyle's fire, they will be soon. I should take pleasure in this noble combat, like the techs are. But I don't. I don't want to see Hoyle.
a Lorik enemy whom I've never even met, be murdered. Yet, despite my conflicted feelings about the mission, I also don't want to see my father turned into a pile of ash. My only choice is to turn away. The techs are so absorbed by the action, they don't hear when the station monitoring internet activity chimes. I inch my chair over to the screen, squinting at a red-flagged blog posting. It reads, 9, now 8. Are the rest of you out there? Chapter 16. It takes only a few keystrokes to isolate the blog posting's IP address. It's here, in London. The techs aren't paying any attention to me, especially now that calls for tactical support are coming in. Hoyle is proving to be one hell of a distraction. A few keystrokes more, and I've pinpointed the location to an address only a few blocks from the Mogadorian base. I've discovered the location of a fugitive guard. Not the general, not Ivan, me. For a moment, I feel a swelling of pride. Take that, Ivan! I guess growing big and strong doesn't count for everything after all. Now, what do I do with this information? I should turn the guard's location over to the techs, have them call my father back from battle. It would mean major glory for myself and my family, and another step for Mogadorian progress. It's what I was raised to do. And I almost do it, but as soon as the thrill of discovery passes, I realize I don't want that at all. I want to help this guard. Maybe I can prevent another scene like Malaysia. Wait, is that what I want? Or is that one of one's suggestions, a thought left over from traveling through her memories? If I'm hallucinating her, is there even a difference between one's thoughts and my own anymore? Deep stuff, says one, peering at the computer's screen over my shoulder. Maybe sort out your philosophical questions after we've saved this one's life, That settles it. I minimize the report before the techs have a chance to see it and slip out of the room. I run down hallways now empty of personnel, all of them having joined the ambush on Hoyle. The way I figure it, I've got only as long as Hoyle can keep fighting. After that, the techs will most certainly discover the blog post and relay the details to the strike team. I'm already winded when I reach the street. I have to push myself. My leg muscles feel about ready to snap after years of disuse. My lungs are on fire, gray spots floating in and out of my vision. Still, I strip off my coat, which marks me as a Mogadorian, and begin to run. Sirens sound in the distance, the local authorities on their way to the site of the battle. It takes me 10 minutes to get to the quiet back street where the building is. I can't believe the guard safe house was right under our noses. If we had waited, Conrad Hoyle would have come to us, and all the mayhem on the streets could have been avoided. Of course, it's lucky for me that things played out like they did. I'm gasping for breath as I stand at the doorway to the building. It's an old red brick townhouse, now home to 3 apartments, according to the buzzers outside. Luckily, an old woman is just leaving to walk her white, puffy dog, and I'm able to catch the front door before it closes. I race to the 2nd-floor apartment, the only one not to have a name stickered to the buzzer downstairs. I pound on the apartment door, probably too hard. If I was a fugitive guard, that kind of loud knocking would send me running for the fire escape. I hear startled movement inside the apartment, a TV being muted, and then silence. I knock again, gentler this time, and press my ear to the door. Muffled footsteps pad closer to the other side of the door, but the girl says nothing. "Open the door," I whisper, trying to keep my voice gentle and urgent. "You're in danger." No response. "Your Sepan sent me," I try. "You need to get out of here." There's a lengthy pause, and then a small voice answers.
How do I know you're telling the truth?
Good question, but I don't have time for this. By now, Conrad Hoyle has probably been overcome by the Mogadorian strike team. I could tell this girl that her Sepan is as good as dead, that my people will be here soon. I could try breaking down the door, but I doubt I have the strength. Just like that, one is standing next to me in the hallway. Her face is somber and distant.
Tell her about the night they came, says one. The night your people came.
I think back to one's memory of the airstrip, the frightened faces around her, the mad dash towards the ship. I remember the night they came, I begin, uncertainly at first, but gaining confidence as I go. There were 9 of us, and our Sepans all running panicked. We saw a guard fight off a piken. I don't think he survived. Then they pushed us onto the ship, and... I trail off, recounting the last night of Lorien making me feel strangely sad. I glance to where one was standing, but she's disappeared back into my head. A half dozen deadbolt locks are unlatched, and the apartment door swings open.